I'm Michael Hawes. You're listening to Bobcat Logic. Home sweet home, Harpocrates, and a grain of salt.
Let's get started on part two.
Now, I knew as a child that the Cherokees were not indigenous to Texas. They hailed from farther east in the Smoky Mountains. Some scholars I had read held out theories based on the peculiar way the Cherokee basketry was finished on the rims and the types of materials employed, such as hickory strips, that rather than coming from Asia over the land bridge and the Ice Age, that they had traveled north from deep in the Orinoco River Basin in South America. There are written records extant, written and verbal, in the cultures of indigenous peoples of the Great Lakes of the coming of people from the south who were warred upon and driven back south to the known home region of the Cherokees. Others conclude the same based on studies of the peculiarities of the Cherokee language and its dissimilarity to other Aboriginal tongues of North America. That's a lot of mystery right out of the gate. It became popular in the 1800s to theorize that the Cherokees in particular, but not exclusively, were remnants of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. This theory still has many adherents among Jews, Aboriginals, and others. This is part of a larger theory that encompasses peoples in Africa and Asia who are said to be descended from the lost tribes. These speculations are fascinating to study in and of themselves, and as is the case of the gypsies, the words, arts, customs, and genes of wandering peoples may always be discerned if one knows what to look for. It must always be borne in mind that at the head of the theories many times, as is the case in the Lost 10 Tribes, are documents written after the facts, many of which conflict with other documents of equal age and veracity. Mordecai M. Noah was the writer of theories of the Jewishness of some Native Americans. He proposed that the Canaanites came over the land bridge first. Here's a quote from his pamphlet. Quote, "They were the Canaanites, the scriptural titans, who, according to the sacred historian, built cities with walls and towers reaching to the heavens. The builders of the Tower of Babel, the family of the shepherd kings who conquered Egypt, and built the pyramids, and were driven from Syria by Joshua. The men who finally founded Tyre and Carthage, navigated around the continent of Africa, and sailed in their small craft across the Atlantic, and landed in the Gulf of Mexico. The Phoenicians were the founders of Palenque, Mitlan, Papantla, Quemada, Cholula, Chila, and Antiquera. When I studied the history of these people on the ruins of Carthage, it was said by the antiquarians present that the Carthaginians had a colony at a considerable distance, which they secretly maintained. And when I was in Tangiers, the Mauritania Tangitania of the ancients, I was shown the spot where the pillar was erected, and was standing in the time of Ibnu, the Moorish historian, on which was inscribed, in the Phoenician language, quote, 'We are the Canaanites who fled from Joshua, the son of Nun, that notorious robber.' Unquote. From that spot, then, the Pillars of Hercules, now known as the Straits of Gibraltar, they crossed to our continent and founded a great empire of the Ophite worship with Syrian and Egyptian symbols. Now, mark the issue. 1500 years after the expulsion of the Canaanites by Joshua, the 10 tribes pass over the Straits of Bering to the continent of America and poured down upon these people like Goths and Vandals. The descendants of Joshua, a second time, fell on the Canaanites in another continent, knowing them well as such, and burn their temples and destroy their gigantic towers and cities." Unquote. 1837. From Discourse of the Evidence of the American Indians Being the Descendants of the Lost Tribes of Israel by Mordecai M. Noah. Mordecai owned newspapers in New York, such as the National Advertiser, the New York Enquirer, which merged into the New York Courier and Enquirer, the Evening Star, and the Sunday Times. He bought land in Grand Island in the Niagara River and created a refuge for Jews which he called Ararat. From Wikipedia, we learn that on September 2nd, soon after arriving in Buffalo from New York, thousands of Christians and a smattering of Jews assembled for a historic event. Noah led a large procession headed by Masons, a New York militia company, and municipal leaders to St. Paul's Episcopal Church. There was a brief ceremony, including a singing of the Psalms in Hebrew. The cornerstone was laid on the communion table, which read, Ararat, a city of refuge for the Jews, founded by Mordecai M. Noah in the month of Tishri, 5586, September 1825, and in the 50th year of the American independence. The proclamation establishing the refuge was read. The day ended with music, cannonade, and libation. 24 guns, recessional, Masons retired to the Eagle Tavern. No one ever set foot on Grand Isle. Mordecai returned to New York without setting foot on the island. The cornerstone was taken out of the audience chamber of the church and laid against the back of the building. It's now on permanent display at the Buffalo Historical Society in Buffalo, New York. Despite the failure of his project, he developed the idea of settling the Jews in Palestine and can be considered as the very founder of modern Zionism. Unquote. Herzl came along decades later, so this statement appears reasonable to me. So, we have a man who owned four newspapers, just looking for a home. This Mordecai turned down a consulship to Riga, Latvia, given him by President James Madison in 1811. 2 years later, he accepted an appointment as consul to the Kingdom of Tunis. 2 years later, he was fired on the grounds that, in the words of James Monroe, his religion was, quote, an obstacle to the exercise of his consular function, end quote. Another man, John Howard Payne, subscribed to the theory of the Lost Tribes. Payne is famous mostly for a song he wrote the lyrics to, called Home Sweet Home. His maternal grandfather, Aaron Isaacs, was said to have come from Hamburg, Germany. He spent time in New York City and was listed as a member of the Temple Sheerth, Israel, in 1748. He was a merchant who shipped goods on consignment between Long Island and Connecticut and was employed as a courier during the American Revolution. Payne was a consul to Tunis. Here we go again. For 10 years after being appointed by President John Tyler in 1842. He was buried there in Tunisia and disinterred in 1883, brought back to New York, and then buried in Washington, D.C. He went in 1836 to visit John Ross, a Cherokee chief who opposed the removal policy of the United States. He also visited Major Ridge, another Cherokee leader, who supported the removal. His travels around the South were supposed to be for the purpose of canvassing subscriptions and literary materials for a new weekly magazine he proposed to call Jam Jehan Nima, which means the world from the inside of a bowl. Payne stayed quite some time with Ross and compiled much information as to the customs of the tribe, as well as transcribing the official Cherokee records. He and Ross were jailed by the Georgia Guard and released after Major Ridge intervened on their behalf. Payne wrote letters, which were placed in newspapers, and some of these were supposed to speak for all Cherokees, which of course wasn't the case, and incensed many people, both white and Cherokee. The notes he made as to the customs and traditions were held privately until just a few years ago. I purchased them and I read both volumes. They're wholly concerned with finding similarities between Cherokee customs and ancient Judaic customs in order to support Mr. Noah's theory. There's no way to know if they are accurate, and I wonder why they were held in a private collection for over 150 years. Payne was educated at Union College in Schenectady, New York. One of his contemporary classmates at Union College was a man named John F. Schermerhorn. This fellow was sent on a mission by the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel. The Society was chartered by King William III in 1701. John's report to the trustees of the Missionary Society of Connecticut was published in pamphlet form in Hartford, Connecticut in 1814. It was entitled, A Correct View of That Part of the United States Which Lies West of the Allegheny Mountains With Regard to Religion and Morals by John F. Schermerhorn and Samuel J. Mills. In 1832, President Andrew Jackson appointed Schermerhorn one of a commission to remove the Cherokee and Chickasaw tribes beyond the Mississippi River, later to be known as the Trail of Tears. While Indian commissioner, he acquired about 400,000 acres of land in Highland, Grayson, Bath, and Wythe counties in Virginia. He and Payne met each other in Cherokee country while he was trying to secure a removal treaty. Payne was lobbying for the Ross Party, and this placed the two schoolmates directly opposite of each other, kind of like the old dialectic we're confronted with all down through history. Payne had some friends of interest, two of which were the Colt brothers of Hartford, Connecticut. Samuel Colt made repeating pistols, and his brother John C. was an authority on double-entry bookkeeping. From Wikipedia, we glean that John Colt was born in Hartford, Connecticut. His father was Christopher Colt, a farmer who had moved his family to Hartford when he changed professions and became a businessman. Colt's father sent him to Hopkins Academy when he was just 9 years old, but he removed him from that school after a year, as John was constantly in trouble and the elder Colt had lost his fortune in the economic panic of 1819. His mother, Sarah Colt, née Caldwell, died of tuberculosis when Colt was only 11 years old. The children were cared for by Christopher's sister, Lucretia Colt Price, until Christopher Colt remarried 2 years later to Olivia Sargent. The Colt family included 7 siblings, 4 boys and 3 girls. The eldest sister, Margaret, died of tuberculosis 2 years after Colt married Sargent. Another of the sisters died in childhood. One of his brothers, Samuel Colt, achieved wealth and fame by founding the Colt's Manufacturing Company. Sargent had 3 children with Colt and had little time for the children from the first marriage. Having lost their financial status, Olivia insisted that these children be put to work rather than receive any schooling. The Colt brothers became attached to their one remaining sister, Sarah Ann, who acted as a surrogate mother of sorts until she was sent from the house to a relative's to work as a menial. John was known to keep locks of her hair and Margaret's all through his life. Colt worked as an assistant bookkeeper at age 14 for the Union Manufacturing Company in Marlborough, Connecticut. He left the job and moved to Albany, New York in less than a year. He returned to Hartford in 1826 and studied at an academy for 3 months. In 1827, he found employment as a math teacher at a ladies' seminary in Baltimore, Maryland, for a year. In 1828, he became a supervisory engineer for a canal near Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. The following year, his sister Sarah Ann committed suicide by taking arsenic. One newspaper account stated that it was due to a fight with her stepmother, and another said, quote, "she took a morbid view of her doom to labor," unquote, until her, quote, "fortitude and her mind gave away," unquote. Devastated by this loss, John vowed to, quote, "leave the country and pass the rest of his days in some foreign land," end quote. In despair, he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. His orders were for a Mediterranean cruise on the USS Constitution. Illness prevented him from serving on the ship, and he worked as a clerk in Norfolk, Virginia, for Colonel Anderson. Colt spent 3 months as a Marine and was disillusioned with the military lifestyle. Clerking in a humid port was not the adventurous life he had envisioned. He was still very ill, but not ill enough for a medical discharge. So, he forged a letter in the name of George Hamilton, a farmer from Ware, Massachusetts, stating that his underage son had falsely enlisted under the name of John Colt. He mailed the letter to his brother James and asked James to mail it to Colonel Anderson from Ware, Massachusetts. Anderson discharged Colt within days of receiving the letter, citing Colt's illness as the reason and not fraudulent enlistment. Upon his discharge, Colt spent a year as a law clerk for his cousin, Dudley Selden, who was born in 1794, November 7th, and he died in 1855 in Paris, France. Dudley Selden was an American lawyer and politician from New York. He was the son of Joseph Dudley Selden and Ethelinda Colt. He married Mary Augusta Packard, and they had a daughter, Maria Louisa Selden, who married William Rogers Morgan. Selden graduated from Union College, Schenectady, New York, in 1819. He studied law. He was admitted to the bar and commenced the practice of his profession in New York City in 1831. He was a member of the New York State Assembly in 1831. Selden was elected as a Jacksonian to the 23rd United States Congress and served from March 4, 1833 to July 1, 1834, when he resigned. He is buried at the Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York. Now, at the same time he was clerking for Dudley Selden, Colt became a riverboat gambler and was challenged to a duel over a shared mistress. Although the two never did fight the duel, this incident would become part of Colt's backstory of being a roughneck, street-fighting, gambling man. He traveled to Vermont in 1830 as a debate coach for the University of Vermont at Burlington. However, he left after a year due to symptoms of tuberculosis. Colt then traveled to the Great Lakes for relief from the disease, and he bought a farm in Michigan on Gooden's Lake. However, those tubercular symptoms surfaced again, and he soon left for Cincinnati, Ohio, where he became a teacher of one of the first correspondence courses in America. Also, he became the center of a bohemian circle, and he counted John Howard Payne and Hiram Powers among his friends. From there, he attempted many business ventures throughout the USA. Land speculator in Texas, soap manufacturer in New York, grocery wholesaler in Georgia, fur trader, dry goods merchant in Florida, and an organizer of Mardi Gras masquerade balls in New Orleans. Payne served as a character witness for John C. at John's trial for the murder of a printer named Samuel Adams, to whom Colt owed money for the publication of a bookkeeping textbook he had written. The two disagreed over the final amount owed. Sources indicate that it was a discrepancy of $1.35. Colt killed Adams with a hatchet in what he claimed was self-defense, but afterwards he covered up the crime by disposing of the body in a box of salt which he tried to ship to a fake address in New Orleans. On September 28, after exhausting his final appeal, Colt was sentenced to death by hanging and remanded to the New York City's infamous prison called the Tombs. His sentence was to be carried out on November 14, in 1842. Colt asked that he be allowed to marry Caroline Henshaw on the morning of his hanging. While imprisoned, Colt lived luxuriously in his prison cell, receiving daily visits from his friends and family, smoking Cuban cigars, sleeping in an actual bed instead of a mound of straw, and wearing silk dressing gowns inside and a sealskin overcoat for his daily walks in the prison yard. His cell contained the latest novels, a gilded bird cage with a canary, and fresh flowers brought to him every day by Henshaw. He dined on meals from local hotels such as quail on toast, game pâtés, and reed birds. Several attempts were made to break him out of the prison by dressing him in women's clothing, but all these efforts were foiled. A doctor was hired who claimed he could resuscitate Colt from the hanging, providing the body did not remain suspended too long, as he believed Colt's neck to be of such thickness that strangulation would be impossible. Colt's friend put the doctor up in the Shakespeare Hotel on the morning of the scheduled hanging and planned to bring the body there from the Tombs for resuscitation. On the morning of November 14, 1842, Colt and Henshaw were married in the prison at a small ceremony conducted by Reverend Harry Anthon, an Episcopal minister, and witnessed by Samuel Colt and John Howard Payne. After the ceremony, and a few hours before the scheduled execution, a fire broke out in the Tombs. After the fire was extinguished, Colt's body was found in his cell. He had apparently stabbed himself in the heart with a pocket knife, believed to have been smuggled to him by a family member. His body was taken by Reverend Anthon and buried in the churchyard of St. Mark's Church in the Bowery. Here is what a former chief of police of New York said in his book regarding this very busy day. Quote, I have heard it declared over and over again by those in a position to know that Colt did not commit suicide, that the body found in his cell when the tombs caught fire was only a corpse prepared for the purpose, and that he escaped in the confusion. The coroner, it is said, was aware of the deception. Persons who knew Colt well are positive they have seen him since the time of his alleged suicide in both California and in Texas. Unquote. That man's name was George Washington Walling. He wrote that in 1887. It's called Recollections of a New York Chief of Police by the Caxton Book Concern, cited from page 26. From Wikipedia, we learn from Colt historian William Edwards that Caroline Henshaw married Samuel Colt in Scotland and that the son she bore was Samuel Colt's and not John Colt's. In a 1953 biography about Samuel Colt, based largely on family letters, Edwards wrote that John's marriage to Caroline was a way to legitimize her son, Sammy. Samuel Colt had abandoned her because he felt she was not fit to be the wife of an industrialist, and divorce was a social stigma at that time. Samuel Colt took care of the child, named Samuel Caldwell Colt, financially, with a large allowance and paid for his tuition in what was described as the finest private schools. In correspondence with and about his namesake, Samuel Colt referred to him as his nephew, in quotes. Historians such as Edwards and Harold Schechter have said that this was the elder Colt's way of letting the world know that the boy was his own son, without directly saying so. After Samuel Colt's death in 1862, he left the boy $2 million by 2010 standards. Colt's widow, Elizabeth Jarvis Colt, and her brother contested this. In probate, Caroline's son Sam produced a valid marriage license showing that Caroline and Samuel Colt were married in Scotland in 1838 and that this document made him a rightful heir to part of Colt's estate, if not to the Colt Manufacturing Company. Captain Samuel Walker of the Texas Rangers had acquired some of the first Colt revolvers ever produced during the Seminole War, and had seen firsthand their effective use as his 15-man unit defeated a larger force of 70 Comanches in Texas. Walker wanted to order Colt revolvers for use by the Rangers in the Mexican-American War, and he traveled to New York City in search of Colt. He met Mr. Colt in a gunsmith shop on January 4, 1847, and he placed an order for 1,000 revolvers. Walker asked for a few changes. The new revolvers would have to hold 6 shots instead of 5, have enough power to kill either a man or a horse with a single shot, and be quicker to reload. This large order allowed Colt to establish a new firearm business. His factory in Hartford built the sidearms used by both the North and the South in the American Civil War, and his firearms were credited in taming the Western frontier. Some other men of interest during these times that we're speaking of were Hayden Edwards, John Dunn Hunter, Peter Samuel Davenport, John Marie Durst, and Adolphus Stern.
We'll meet back up on this ridge next week, and we'll talk about these fellas in part 3.
Come on, Zigzag. Looks like rain.